No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Kathleen Gomez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Or Skype us at BBS Radio 1. Today we're going to depart a little from our ongoing discussion of the middle class that we started last week and that we hope to continue in the weeks to come. And we're going to talk about mothers, because today's Mother's Day.
Yay.
Today we pay homage to our mothers. We send them flowers, we buy them cards, we make them useless paperweights and write them bad poetry in school, things that they keep forever. But in the end, as a nation, we don't treat our mothers very well. We spend $20 billion, that's with a B, $20 billion today buying cards and gifts and other things for our moms. But unfortunately, the truth of the matter is that women are still second-class citizens in America, and we're going to talk about that today. But before we get started, let me introduce my co-host, who is in fact a great mother herself, Kathleen Gomez, joining us from the great state of Arizona. Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for helping get the conversation started. What did your sons do for you today? Let's put him on the spot.
My youngest, you know, came out early to watch the soccer game because there's a huge tournament going on in England, you know. And I'm sitting there looking at him, expecting him to remember. And as he sits there, I go, so I had to, you know, of course, say, Mateo, do you know what day it is today? And he goes, Sunday. I said, yeah. I said, it's Sunday. You're right. I said, but there's any other thing that's going on today? And he looked at me. Oh, yeah. He goes, it's Mother's Day, but I thought it was next Sunday. I thought, okay. Wow. So, you know, and he goes, happy Mother's Day. And my older son, who's in the midst of finals, told me that they want to take me out on Wednesday. He has to go to work at 3. And basically what it is, you know, men don't plan. You have to plan these things. You have to make reservations. And the fact that they're 19 and 14, I guess I have to give him a break because you know how young boys are at that age. They somewhat are kind of self-involved. So they are taking me out to dinner on Wednesday after his finals. And hopefully we'll see if they remember.
Well, first of all, you make that statement, that sexist statement about men because you don't have girls. 14-year-old girls are also self-involved in 19-year-old girls. But I know that you were on Dr. Miller's show today talking about lessons you learned from your mother, and you just taught Mateo a very important lesson. When a woman looks at you and says, do you know what day it is? You better do some damn quick thinking.
Exactly.
You either missed a birthday or an anniversary or you missed something. Yeah, when they ask a question like that. So he just learned something that may save him a lot of pain in life with dealing with women.
And he had that look in his eyes like, okay, like, you know, the deer caught in the headlights where he was like, okay, something, and then of course I love the excuse, but I thought it was next Sunday. I said, okay, whatever. But it was a funny thing.
Yes, only something a teenage boy would say. You know,
exactly.
We need to push things back a week. Yeah. So, Anyway, well, as we get started, let me just do my obligatory recount of what's happened to the rights of district residents this week. The House Oversight Government Reform Committee, Subcommittee on Government Operations, held a hearing on a law passed to decriminalize marijuana in the District of Columbia. Now, the thing that's unusual about this is they've held other hearings, but they've never held hearings about any laws that are specific to any particular state or other jurisdiction, because they can't. When Arizona passed its law for medical marijuana, Congress really didn't have anything to say about it. They can have a federal law, but they can't interfere with state laws. And Representative John Fleming, a Republican, of course, from Louisiana, said he is considering introducing legislation to block the law. That's not likely, because it's only happened a few times in our history. Although Congress has the right to do it, what he would have to do in the next 60 days is pass a law that was passed, or introduce legislation passed by both houses of Congress and signed into law by the president. So it's not likely that he'll do that. But what he might do is try to interfere somewhere on the appropriations process. And the one thing that really stands out about all this is that when they asked him why he was interfering with the law in the district, he said, because I can. I can't interfere with the laws in the states, but I can interfere with the law in the District of Columbia. So, you know, I mean, it's just crazy. We do that over and over again. It happens to us, and it's just crazy in the world's greatest democracy that we put up with this. And I'd like to remind our listeners that of the 642,000 people that live in the District of Columbia without equal rights, more than half of them are women, and many of them are our mothers. So on Mother's Day, do something nice for a mother in the District of Columbia. Support DC statehood. Go on our website, statehood now, statehoodnow.org, and sign the petition to make the District of Columbia that a state. That's statehoodnow.org. So now let's talk about women.
I have one question to ask you about what you just said. Now, because you are not a state, does the Constitution, are you really protected by the Constitution?
No, actually, we're abused by the Constitution. And that's what's gotten us in the situation that we're in, is that Article 1, Section 2 of the Constitution says that Congress shall have the right to create all laws in the District of Columbia. They should have exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever. So the Constitution says that Congress has total control of the district and they can do whatever they want. And that's where our problem lies. And that's why we can't get satisfaction in the courts, for example, under the 14th Amendment, under equal protection, for example, because we're not protected the same way the people of Arizona are. But you can't find something unconstitutional that's actually in the Constitution. So that's our problem. We're not protected. And they can do whatever they want. And when they granted us home rule, one of the provisions that they put in the home rule charter was that every law passed by the District of Columbia City Council and signed by the mayor needed to sit in Congress for 60 days. Well, it depends. There are different levels depending on the law. But up to 60 legislative days, which, you know, if this happens in the summertime, can be months and months. Yeah.
Right.
And that Congress has the right to review those laws and to change them if it wants. So that's the situation we find ourselves in.
Well, it's interesting in me bringing up the Constitution on today being Mother's Day, that and this is still, you know, when we first started our show over a year ago, we did have a guest talked about where the ERA is today. And I was shocked to realize that it had never passed. And I don't think women understand anymore. I think we all think that somehow it passed and everything's okay, that it's not okay. Because even in 2010, Justice Scalia said that as far as he was concerned, the 14th Amendment has been applied to sex discrimination. It's only been since 71. But he said that he does not think that the Constitution prohibits sex discrimination as the way he reads it. And the fact that women, we do not have this Equal Rights Amendment, we are not protected under the Constitution. The only thing that we are guaranteed is the right to vote, and that's it. And I don't think that women understand that that's where where women stand in today's society, the United States of America. We're only guaranteed the right to vote, and that's it.
Well, and you know what? That's what's so crazy about this. Because the Equal Rights Amendment, this is the Equal Rights Amendment. This is the language of the Equal Rights Amendment. It says equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on account of sex. That's it. It doesn't say anything more than that. There are two other provisions that say Congress will have the right to enforce the legislation and that it will take effect 2 years after ratification. But those are technical things that refer to how the law will be implemented. But the meat of the amendment just says you can't abridge somebody's right on the basis of their sex, and that's it. You know, and I think most of us would agree with that women, you know, should have the same rights as men. And it's just crazy that we can't pass this. And I think it shows how much misogyny is still left in our society, unfortunately. You know, we all talk about how great our moms and our sisters and our wives and our girlfriends and our daughters are. But then in the end, we have a problem standing up for them. And that's what's sad about all this.
And it's interesting that, excuse me, in 2012, there was a poll taken, and it found that 91% of Americans believe that men and women should have equal rights affirmed by the Constitution. And in, this goes back a little bit farther, but in 2001, a poll showed that 96% of U.S. adults believe male and female citizens should have equal rights. And 88% said that the Constitution should guarantee equal rights. I mean, it's amazing to me, and I've said this before, that we are in the midst of guaranteeing rights for gay couples, for transgender, you know, citizens, on, and yet we haven't realized that one of the most important, like, 51% of the population are women, do not have their rights guaranteed under our Constitution. And I think that if there's any one issue that you also get behind, I think it's go on to now, you know, the National Organization of Women, the National Council of Women's Organizations. Just go in and Google the ERA and go online and see what's going on. And we need, I think it is, three more states, if I'm correct, before we can pass it so that it will go as an amendment to the Constitution or go back to Congress. And, you know, they have been extending it since, actually, this is something that's kind of been in the process since 1923. And they've, in 1971, extended it because the time was going to run out in which we could have those states we need to be ratified and take it to Congress. And if it stops, if that extension doesn't happen, then we have to start from square one all over again. And, you know, I think when I look at today's young women, I don't think they understand the situation either. Because as we talk about issues of minimum wage and all those things that are affecting mothers today and single parents, it's not going to really matter if you don't have that right protected in the Constitution.
Well, you know, you're right. Alice Paul first wrote the Equal Rights Amendment in 1923. So it's been out, you know, for almost 100 years. It wasn't introduced until the 1970s, but until 1971, I think. And it was passed in 1972, which is 42 years ago, and still waiting for ratification. Now, it's Mother's Day, so I hate to beat you up on Mother's Day, but I feel that I must point out that one of the states that hasn't ratified yet is good old Arizona.
Doesn't surprise me one bit. And, you know, I haven't looked at the statistics, but I wouldn't doubt it. I think women in Arizona are at a real disadvantage because they have Maricopa Phoenix does not really have much interest in the plight of women and women in poverty, women as single mothers and what their situation is. This is a crazy state. It is a very crazy state where you get everything from Morris Udall to you know, priests or pastors that are, as you know, you may have seen in the news that there was a pastor that was saying, young man who was claiming that women actually ask to be raped by the clothes that they wear. And if you wear yoga pants, well, then you are asking to be raped. And I thought, oh my gosh. And this is on the campus of the University of Arizona. And, you know,
well,
place. I'm that's sorry. All I can say. No, that's all right. Go ahead.
Well, the question that I would like to ask that young man is that I'm a feminist. I think that women, you know, I was raised by women. I think women should at least have equal rights, if not extra rights, because they do so much more in our society than men do. But they have to play so many roles. But what I'd like to ask that young man is if I was walking down the street and I saw him wearing a T-shirt that said, you deserve to be raped because you wear yoga pants. And it infuriated me. And I saw a 2x4 on the side of the street and I picked it up and whacked him real hard in the head with it. Would he be partially responsible for that because of the clothes he was wearing?
Or what he was saying that he basically,
I mean, because he was wearing a T-shirt. Yeah. You know, he shouldn't wear those clothes in public.
And I think he carries a sign that says
he
that.
He does. So, he carries a sign.
So at what point, you know, then is he responsible for whatever he gets back because of what he promotes? It's a very, very sad, you know, situation to think that that's what this young man, you know, really, truly believes. And the one thing that women have to understand also is that if we have the ERA, for all the progress, and, you know, when we talk about equal pay. When I started working, I remember this to the day. It was in the early 1980s, 81, 82, something like that. Women were making 15 cents to the dollar. Now it is 2014, and they are making 77 cents to the dollar. Well, without that ERA amendment to protect women's rights, it would, you know, if we had that, it would be a lot, it would be very difficult for lawmakers to try to roll back any progress that women have made. If we have the ERA amendment, it just secures the rights and what we've done in the past 40, 50 years and secures that those things won't be taken away from us. So in so many ways, the ERA is very, very important to women's livelihoods, to their ability to have their status in the, you know, our society, and just what it must say to the rest of the world. I mean, we claim to be a true democracy. You know, we don't do that for people. We don't give them democracy in District of Columbia, and we're not doing that for women who are the majority of the population of this country. So it's quite frightening.
Well, it's true, and you have the same problem here that we have, and that is, you know, when you say 96% of people believe that women should have the same rights, 80% of people believe that Washingtonians should have the same rights. But we need people to stand up. And, you know, I want to talk about a few other things, but later in the show I'd like to discuss, you know, how much culpability do women have for not banding together, because they are 51% of the population and they could change this. We see the impact they have. We might have our first woman president soon. At least it's, you know, whether Hillary Clinton makes it or not, at least she's a viable candidate. So things are changing for women. We see women CEOs now in major corporations like Yahoo and General Motors, but in general, they're still in the same place, 76 cents. I mean, 76 cents on the dollar. And they really ought to do something about it. And you know what? I don't understand why men aren't more involved, because most men are married to women and they have a family income. So if your wife's out there working, and it's likely that she is, because women make up so much more of the workforce today. They make up 48% of the workforce. So that's almost half. And if your wife's out there working and making 76 cents on the dollar, you're getting taken advantage of because your family income is less. And so it's not just a woman's issue. It's a family issue, as all issues with women are. They're family issues, and men should be more involved, and men should be fighting for women to have equal rights and equal pay. And, you know, it's amazing for me because we passed legislation that says that women should get equal pay for equal work, but still they make 76 cents on the dollar. And we'll talk about a few of those things in a minute, why that is. But, you know, I want to talk a second about Mother's Day. It was started by Anna Garvis in 1908. She had no children, but she thought it would be a great idea if you would bring your mother a flower on Mother's Day and maybe go to church with her and stop in and tell her how much she meant. She was upset that all the holidays that we celebrated revolved around men, so she wanted to start a holiday around women. And in the end, when Congress made it an official holiday in 1914, she started to protest against it. She hated the fact that it became commercial. One of the guys that financed her original plan, her original campaign, was Sam Wanamaker. And, you know, Wanamaker's was a famous department store back in those days. So Sam had a vested interest. You know, I think he realized right away, just like Valentine's Day and other holidays, that he could make a buck off of it. But it upset her. She didn't mean it to be a holiday where we spent $20 billion on our mothers, which is what we're expected to spend this year. She wanted it to be a holiday where you took the time to stop and realize how important women are, how important your mothers are. I mean, which one of us would have made it in life successfully without help from our mothers? I mean, they really are the most important people in our lives, and the fact that we don't that we pay homage to them, but then we as we say in Washington, we talk the talk, but we don't walk the walk, I think reflects poorly on us as a nation.
And you know, it's interesting because it has become so commercial. And, you know, when it really is just, I think, what she probably, and what you stated was, it was just to stop a moment and appreciate the person that has done so much for you. And Yes. And I think of, you know, what happens. I was reading something, you know, we've always talked about the disappearing, and, you know, it's been a big issue of mine, of the middle class. And one of the statistics is that how women do go into poverty, especially in a situation of a divorce, and how many single women there are out there, you know, struggling with the fact that they are in mostly jobs that don't pay that well, that they don't get equal pay when they are in positions of maybe more of a managerial or executive situations. And, you know, and the impact that has on their home life and on the life of their children. I mean, this is something that really, I think, women, when you're talking about, you know, what's going on with them, I think one of the biggest things that we have done is we do not teach the girls, our young girls, how this has come about, how they're able to apply for scholarships in colleges because Title IX was passed. You know, I tell the story. I was a Rotarian in my hometown of Douglas, and we had junior Rotarians. We were bringing kids from the high school. And at that day, we had three young girls, and they were the top in sports. I think basketball, I think it was tennis, and I can't, maybe softball. And I was kind of intrigued. Did they understand that they were here today because of a law that was passed maybe, 30 years ago? Yeah. And I asked them, do you know what Title IX is? And they looked at me. They didn't even have any inclination. I asked them if they knew what the ERA stood for. They had no idea. And I said to them, do you understand that the reason you're sitting here right now is because women band together 30, 40 years ago to give you this opportunity? And they had no clue what I was talking about. They were thinking, oh, my gosh, what is this woman, you know, on this kind of soapbox about? We don't know what she's talking about. And that, I think, we no longer have a public school system that teaches really history. History doesn't seem to be really important and part of the curriculum. So mothers and women need to teach their young daughters and sisters or whatever it may be how important it is for us to stand together in times like this. And this is one thing we should stand together, get the ERA passed.
Well, you know, I we're going to have to argue about this a little bit because I agree with you.
You love to argue.
I do love to argue, and I agree with what you're saying, but I also see in African-American children that they understand the sacrifice that was made for them, for their right. Right to vote. So I wonder what we've done, and maybe that is a matter of history. Maybe we, you know, we have Black History Month,
right.
And we teach kids about Black history, and the Civil Rights Movement, of course, happened in my lifetime in the 1960s. It wasn't that long ago, where the women's suffragist movement was at the beginning of the 19th century. I mean, I'm sorry, the beginning of the 20th century. So there aren't a lot of people around that remember women marching on the White House for the right to vote and some of the things that women had to do to get even accepted in the workforce after the Second World War and all the things that they've done, all the legislation that was passed. I don't know why they don't have as good a sense of that. And maybe we do need to educate girls more in high school and secondary school, you know, primary school, about the sacrifices that have been made. And, you know, I always say, hey, look, if I'm a misogynist, it was women that, you know, I never had a male teacher until I was in high school. So it was women that were training me to be a little sexist jerk when I was a kid, you know?
That had to be also based in the curriculum and the fact that yes. I think women, you know, it took us a while to be able to stand up and say, and believe that we had the right to say, no, you know, we don't accept this. And you know how hard it is to fight something like a national curriculum in which, you know, basically, you know, the thing is, you know, women, you know, remember home ec, you know, women should be. I remember taking classes where they taught me how to get in a car with short skirts so that I would be appropriate and know how to be able to sit in a chair and get in a car without, you know, I guess, showing anything. And I think about that in home ec. I mean, although I think home ec was really, really great, it was only taught to young girls, you know. And so it's we've come a long way, but we've lost the ability to tell the story so that it lives on in our youth and in our young girls so they understand that it's not just they're not entitled to this. In fact, they don't even have that right yet. And that's something that all of us probably don't really understand. These the youth of our day, the young girls in society today are not protected. And it's kind of very I find it hard to understand how we've gotten to that part where these young girls don't get it and they don't understand how close they can be to losing everything that they have expected to be given to them.
Well, that first of all, that shows what a better education you got than I got, because I had to educate myself on how to drop my notebook so I could watch girls get into cars in short skirts. That I had to learn on my own. Nobody taught me that. I had to learn that. I learned that from my friend Joe at the time. But no, seriously, you're so right. And I know we're going to take a break in a minute. And I know when we come back, one of the things we want to talk about briefly, there's a couple of things that have gone on this week. And one of them certainly is the taking of those young women from their boarding school in Nigeria, and you know how horrible that is, and how the there's been this international outcry about it. But it just shows you that, you know, that this attitude that women are less somehow is universal. And if we look at we like to think we're above that, but you know, women have almost doubled their since 1970 their participation in the workforce, from 30 million to 73 million. Actually, their participation's gone up 10%, from 38 to 48% of the workforce. But occupational segregation, which is what I did my master's thesis on when I was doing public policy. I worked on the Equal Rights Amendment, strangely enough, as a research project. It was going on at the time. And I did a survey on occupational segregation. And what this does for women is it provides an oversupply of qualified people in certain professions, so they can be paid less money. You know, it's a matter of supply and demand. And so today you have a situation where 96% of all secretaries are women, so that you can pay them less because there's plenty of them out there. 92% of nurses, more elementary school teachers. Even though the rate of male teachers has increased, there's still women are more likely to be elementary school teachers who get paid less and have less education than men. So there has been some slow progress. Like you say, there's been some CEOs of major corporations like Yahoo and General Motors. We now have things like maternity leave, job sharing, flex schedules, telecommuting. But the bottom line is that women are still considerably more likely to be in poverty than men, and they're more likely to be in poverty than men, regardless of their race, color, education, regardless of what it is, what the other similarities are. The poverty rate between men and women is wider in America than any other place in the Western world. I mean, that's just amazing to me that there's no other place in the Western world where there's such a gap between men and women
Interesting because I worked for Congresswoman Pat Schroeder, who was always a proponent of the Family Leave Act, you know, which allowed either a father or a mother to be able to take time off for a sick kid or parent. But we were the last of the industrialized countries to actually pass that into law. Everyone else had that. And in fact, when you compare us against the other industrialized countries in the world, we are far behind on many of those things, especially, you know, laws that help women in the workforce and, you know, at home. So, well, you know, U.S., we got to, you know, it's amazing how we think and we, you know, pound our chest and we're so great. Yeah, when you really look inside at what's happening and what we do, we're far from actually being a true democracy and protecting citizens, you know, whether for race, sex, creed, whatever. So it's just rather interesting, the status of women in the United States. And I think we need to take a real hard good look at it. And I hope that we can get whoever may be listening to us somewhat get some fire in your gut and say, you know what, of all things, absolutely, women should be protected under the Constitution.
Yes, absolutely. And on that note, we're going to take a short break and we're going to play a song that Kathleen picked out called Moms. the mom song.
Yes.
So here we go. The mom song from the GF guys. In a few minutes.
It's a song from my mommy.
How do you spell it?
Give me an M. M. Give me an O.
Give me an O.
O. Give me an M. 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 What's that spell?
If you have a stroller, but you're still a rock and roller, you're a mom.
You're a mom.
If you're tired of doing dishes and you know who almost fishes, you're a mom.
All right, and we're back. And a message for Mateo Vlasic. Mother's Day is today. It's not
That's next week.
Trying to save you, buddy. All right.
Exactly. But it was a good try. I can see him saying, oh, my gosh, to his girlfriend, I thought your birthday was a month from now.
Yeah,
oh, my gosh.
That, yeah. We'll see how well that works for him.
Exactly.
You know? But you're right. He took a shot, and you have to admire him for that. Anyway, you know what I'd like to move on and talk to you a little bit. One thing that astounded me while I was doing some research, I mean, we knew, I like I said, when I was in graduate school, I studied the Equal Rights Amendment. So I knew some of these things. I also, as a political consultant, worked for a shelter for battered women. So I knew some of the statistics about poverty and some of the things that women have to put up with in our society. But one thing that really amazed me is that I got on a website. There's a group called the Confidence Coalition that's trying to build safe self-esteem in girls. And some of the statistics that I found on that were just amazing. For example, 81%. Now, this is almost 9 out of 10 girls who are 10 years old worry about being too fat.
Yes.
81% of 10-year-old girls worry about being too fat. Now, I've raised a couple daughters, and this 10 years old is just prior to puberty, the onset of puberty. And girls go through a very awkward stage from 10 to 13 to 15 to 16, where they do, where their bodies are developing in different ways, and they do put on weight. And there are lots of 10-year-old girls out there that aren't, you know, going to be tall and gorgeous and thin as a rail, who bulk up a little bit during that time. So it's just amazing to me that they're so self-conscious about the way they look that at 10 years old, they're worried about being too fat. And then they also said that 25%, one in four of every college-age woman in America has an eating disorder.
Right.
And 90% of all women want to change something about their physical appearance.
Oh, that's absolutely true. And you know what's even scarier is what women spend reportedly a year, $426 billion on some form of cosmetics, whether it be shampoo or, you know, and it's amazing to me the kind of thing that the way everything is kind of so, you know, you can be rejuvenated, look fresh, look beautiful, you know, you just use these products. And it's scary how my niece is 8 years old and already, you know, she's got a little baby fat on her. I mean, she's a little girl. And already the kids, you know, she's concerned about if she looks fat, you know, and how everyone is judging her because she's not thin. And it's so sad because it impacts us so early. And I think that's what distracts us from the more important issues that we should be dealing with, is this huge cosmetic industry that tells us in every which way, whether you get up early at night or you can't sleep and you turn on TV and it's all infomercials about how you can be looking younger, you can look, you know, fresher or more alive if you use these products, and look at this, people, look how beautiful you, and you too can be this way. And I think that distracts us from what's really important. And it's a really sad, sad situation, how the marketing industry has done such a good job of convincing women that we will only look good if we use these cosmetic things. And I'm just to blame. I remember my son, the older one, came to the house one time. He says, you know what's good about, you know, having a girlfriend or being in a house where women are? I said, what? He goes, you can have all kinds of different choices for shampoo. Because he buys one shampoo and that's it. No conditioner, nothing. But I think I might have 6 or 7 different kinds in the shower. I am as much of, part of this problem as any woman, you know, between the cosmetics and the firming lotion and the anti-cellulite, this or that. I mean, it's so much of, you know, you're not good enough. But use these products and you might be able to get there.
Well, and I think that leads to a deeper problem too, which is the fact that if you're not good enough, you're willing to accept less, you know?
Right.
You're willing to accept 76 cents on the dollar if you're not good enough. You're willing to accept, you know, we see there's so much problem with violence. This is another, you know, we can't get too deeply into this because this is a not only a show, it's a series of shows, but violence towards women. And, you know, we see so often that women that are battered and abused have low self-esteem. That's right. That's why they put up with it, you know. That's the real problem, is that you're right. It's not just an image thing, you know, in terms of the image you project to the world, but the way you feel about yourself as well. And that's one thing that I have to give credit to Mrs. Obama for. She's started this campaign in the White House to get kids healthy. They never talk about weight. They only talk about good things to eat and how it impacts your health. And that's really what we should be looking at, right? When it comes to food, it shouldn't be whether you're a woman and you're 5'6" and 120 pounds or 160 pounds. It should matter that you're healthy. And that's what should be important. And we should put the emphasis on that. And that's what we do for men. I mean, you know, look, there are a lot of ugly guys out there that have, you know, gorgeous wives. I'm one of them, for example. But, but you know, they're it's not a matter of you know, I think men are becoming more self-conscious about their image these days. But but traditionally, that hasn't been a problem. And that's why I love seeing women on TV like Sofia Vergara, who's so beautiful, you know, because you and I grew up in the age of Twiggy and I forget who the other model, you know, but Elle McPherson, all the women that were tall and a perfect size 00, and you know what I mean,
Mia Farrow, Mia Farrow was
away
one of
from
them.
The Marilyn Monroe type of, you know, or Mae West type of woman.
And I don't know if you remember, but I think it was right around the late 1980s, there was Cindy Crawford, you know, and that was because she actually had a mole, you know, that was, she was beautiful, who cared about the mole. But the fact that there were now women in fashion who were curvy and weren't a stick, but they were, you know, they had curves and they were, you know, still, you know, I think not necessarily representing the normal woman, but there was that chance that, you know, maybe this would be a new break in the way fashion was designed, and it really hasn't made much of a difference. But it's a sad state of affairs. I look at my son who's 19, and I say to him, I said, you know, you haven't even shaved, and you know, you don't have, he has these splotches, right? And he looked at me, goes, well, that's okay. I said, well, don't you care about how you look when you go outside? And he goes, well, no. I mean, he thinks no matter how he gets up and dresses and goes out, it's perfectly acceptable. A young woman, I'm sure a college student, she'd be very rare if she had that same kind of take in life, you know. And I was just thinking how much freedom that is to just not have to look in the mirror and wonder how you look, to just go out and do your business. That must just be so empowering. And I hope someday that women get to that point. And I hope out there, if you're listening, please, women or men or anybody who might have a comment about their mothers or, you know, mothers – rights or women's rights or the ERA will call in at 888-627-6008. Please call us and let us know what you think.
Well, as you say that, I see that Dr. Miller is on line one. So let's talk to Dr. Miller and see what he has to say. Dr. Miller, you're with us?
Yes, I am. Hello to the both of you.
Hello.
Hey, how are you?
Seems like I talked to you guys earlier. Must have been a dream or something.
Yeah, maybe.
So
it was fun. I was part of that dream. It was fun.
We're talking here about a cultural pattern. This is a large part of Western culture and a particularly large part of American culture. Mm-hmm. We put so much emphasis on beauty. We define beauty in some very narrow terms. And then we go on television, movies, and promote this particular image of beauty. And then a whole industry pops up, as you mentioned earlier, Kathleen, to sell you products and services that will hopefully help you get to that particular standard of beauty as defined by our culture and now our capitalistic society. So if you're going to try and do something about this, it's a big problem. It's a huge, huge problem.
Yeah.
Because it's now political, it's economic, it's cultural values, and et cetera. And you're going to have to start probably, and I'll go back to my theme, back to the schools, to try and counterbalance this over-excessive obsession with trying to look like a Barbie doll almost. Remember the old Barbie doll?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Yeah. And I remember when they came out and they said, you know, that proportionately, this was a few years ago, they took a Barbie doll and that would, you know, if they blew her up to life size proportion, it would be a woman with like an 18-inch waist and 28-inch hips. I mean, it was almost impossible for a human being to look the way Barbie looked. And yeah, and I think that's a terrible thing. And I think you're right, Doctor. We need to start educating at the elementary school level that girls need to be accepted for the same reasons that boys are accepted, because they've accomplished things, because they're smart, because they're good at sports, because they're good at making friends, because we need to take the emphasis off the physical. And I see it evolving slowly, but still, I have two daughters. They're very much, you know, they very much care about the way they look.
Well, you know, I didn't get to hear the first part of your show, but I'm going to say something. Maybe you've already covered this, but this emphasis on beauty for women is so disproportional to men, as you just mentioned. Mm-hmm. But for women, this is a lifelong war to meet these standards.
Yes.
Older women, when they get into their 40s, their 50s and 60s, they're not beautiful anymore, according to this Hollywood image.
Right.
And don't say anything about someone who is 70. And to me, I mean, that is such a crime almost, because to me, women, like men, really don't get into how beautiful they are until they in their 40s, their 50s, their 60s. They know themselves. They know their bodies. They know what makes them feel good, what makes them look good. They have so much more input that they can provide to how they look than someone who's a teenager, a 20-something, a 30-something, who's trying to follow that Hollywood-dominated cultural model of this is a picture of beauty. Measure yourself against this.
Well, you know, it's funny you should say that, Dr. Miller, is so ingrained in our society. I remember this was 20 years or more ago, we had a newscaster here in Washington, D.C., and her name was Maureen Bunyan. And she was just drop-dead gorgeous. And when she hit 40, they got rid of her. And it's funny because that very night, it became an issue in Washington. And the very night that she lost her job, the next night, I was at a restaurant with my girlfriend, and they sat next to us, her and a young man that she was with. And we couldn't get over how drop-dead gorgeous she was. And we just, the whole conversation between us was, what are these people, crazy? This woman doesn't have a wrinkle. She doesn't, you know, she's just gorgeous. She's, you know, well-dressed, well-coiffed. And it was just the idea that she had hit 40. And it became such an issue in Washington, they actually, another TV station had the good sense to hire her.
Is she still working in D.C.?
No, she's not. But she worked for another 5 or 10 years, I think, on another station. But yeah, it's so ingrained in us, we don't even bother to look to see. You know, we just go, Mike, oh, she's 40, you know. For a guy, guy's just hitting his stride at 40.
Mike and Kathleen, check this.
Yes.
This is so ingrained that when we find women who are just drop-dead gorgeous in their 40s, their 50s, their 60s, their 70s, you know what we say? Oh, this is the new 50.
Yes.
Right.
This is new
40. Right?
Right.
You're not 70 and just drop-dead gorgeous. You must be the new 70 is 50.
Exactly. And it is so true. And I have said that too myself about, you know, well, this is the new, because we are so, you know, I think I was trained to believe that by the time I hit 40 or 50, and this is not by my mother per se, but from just, you know, marketing and TV, that, you know, I feared getting older because I knew that I would somehow be seen as less worthy. And I remembered, if you guys remember Jane Pauley, who was on the Today Show, who was replaced slowly, but, you know, kind of very, everyone knew it on TV, by Deborah Norvell, who was so much younger. And there was enough of a backlash that poor, you know, Miss Norvell had to go to a lesser station. But that was one of the few instances in which, you know, people said, hey, wait a minute, you don't want to give up a really knowledgeable, intelligent woman for just another pretty young face. But that happens so rarely. And I see it, you know, I'm in my 50s and I see that amongst my peers. You know, we do not embrace getting older because we're taught that it's not going to be good for us. I mean, while a man can age and date whoever he wants, and he only will have, as he gets older, more wisdom and seeing in that sense, women don't have that same type of, you know, outlook and about themselves, nor does the culture have towards them. It's pretty sad.
Well, I just want to say,
well,
right up front,
I don't know about all of that, Kathleen. Mike,
I'm not going to dump you just because you're getting old, Kathleen.
Thank you. That makes me feel so much better. Dr. Miller, I know you're a great guy, and I know you you don't have that attitude, and I want to thank you for everything you do on education. Your show is very good. I encourage people to listen to you if you're listening to our show. You've got a lot of great statistics, and you had actually talked about the fact that most women, two-thirds of the workforce is women making minimum wage, right?
Right.
Yes.
And that's right. And why don't we call it, what was it, a fair wage instead of minimum wage? It sounds, it's so telling in just that title itself, a minimum wage.
Because $10 an hour isn't a fair wage, unfortunately. it is barely a minimum wage. But thanks for calling in, Dr. Miller. We're so happy that you did. And I want to take a moment at the end of the show, now we're almost out of time, to talk for a moment about Marty Cobb. This is a young African-American boy who is my hero. Marty, I don't know if you know this nationwide. This happened in Richmond, Virginia, so I don't know if it's a regional story or what. But Marty Cobb was an 8-year-old boy that had a heart condition, so he was kind of smallish. And a 16-year-old boy attacked his 12-year-old sister and tried to rape her in his backyard. And Marty stood up and intervened and fought the guy off, and the 16-year-old boy killed him. and assaulted the sister. So Marty was a real hero, trying to save his sister. His mother taught him that his sister was his responsibility and that he always needed to stand up for her. And boy, did he stand up for her. And the reason that I point this out is that President Obama, there's a petition on the White House website, and I encourage everybody to go there and sign it to give Marty an award for being a national hero. And I think he deserves it because he shows us all how we should treat women in our society. We shouldn't treat them as second-class citizens. We shouldn't allow them to be abused. We should stand up for each and every one of them. And that's what Marty did. He stood up for his older sister, and God bless him.
Hey, as a woman, do I get the last word today?
Yes, you do.
Oh, God. Okay. Well, I do have to also say something to all those mothers in Nigeria who are fighting to find out where their daughters have been taken. And I, you know, I think we all need to maybe take a moment and pray for the safety of these young girls, because as I was reading stuff, there has been reports they're being sold for $12, you know, as wives. And you know, 256 girls. And not to say that the same group also in February killed 60 young boys at school, killed them through shotguns and burning them. And we as a nation have to stand up not only for our young women, but for these young boys who are being educated. And so my heart goes out to those mothers, because I cannot imagine what they're going through on this day, wondering what's happening to their daughters and if they're still alive. So I hope that we can all say a little prayer for them and wish them the best, because I can't imagine what they're going through.
Absolutely. Thanks, Kathleen. And in closing, let me thank my wife, Pat, for being a great mother, and my friend, Kathleen, for being a great mother, and my mom, Louise, my sister, Patricia, and my grandmother, Rose, all who raised me, all who were great mothers. And for all the mothers out there, thank you for all you do.
Thank you, too. And to my mother, Wendy, to my great-grandmothers who taught me so much, and to my grandmother, Alicia, I thank you all for making me the woman I am today.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.